The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. There. Welcome to Our State Magazine on the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving our community since 1974 and underwriting our podcasts for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And now we return to the March 2023 edition of Our State Magazine. I'm going to start with an article called Framing the Outer Banks. How a charismatic storyteller with an eye for detail transformed North Carolina's quiet barrier islands into a national destination, but preserved their local charm. Written by Rebecca Bengel. There's a picture here. The caption says, Icock Brown, whose picture is on the opposite page, he's an older gentleman with a straw hat, and he's got an old-fashioned camera on his hanging from his neck. I say old-fashioned. It's the kind where the viewfinder flipped up from the top, which was used more by experienced professionals than it were by us amateurs. And he's by a license plate. Apparently, at that time, whenever this was taken, when you could get a personalized a license plate, because his name's there, A-Y-C-O-C-K, on the back of it, and he's in front of the Dare County Tourist Bureau Information Outer Banks area building. And it says he was well known for Outer Banks, around the Outer Banks, for his personalized license plate. There you go. I hadn't even read that. And the cameras draped around his neck. Among his most famous images, fishermen showing off their trophies. And here we are at Odin's Dock in Hatteras, North Carolina. And there's two men standing by swordfish that are as big as they are. And the third man is crouched down, and it says, Icock Brown. Well, I already read you what it says, but here are the men standing there with their heavy-duty fishing rods in the hand, one hand on each of the fins of the trees. Trees of the fish. I don't know, no trees in that picture. I grew up in the western part of North Carolina, roughly 400 miles away from the Outer Banks. For me, the state's barrier islands always existed largely in images remembered and imagined, and perhaps mostly seen in pictures. Joel Sternfeld's color photos made in Nag's Head in the 1970s. The enigmatic black and white narratives that artist Dare Wright staged of her lonely doll and attendant stuffed bears on the shore of mid-century Ocracoke. Those images lodge in my head, along with my own memories of the area, particularly my first flight as a kid in the late 1980s in a tiny plane over Jockey's Ridge, feeling as if I'd traveled to a planet of sand. Last fall, I returned to the North Carolina coast with even more images in my head, a whole current of them, decades of frames by Icock Brown in his archives at the Outer Bank History Center in Manteo, a restlessly dedicated photographer and local tourism director with a huckster's charm. Brown made it his life's work to beckon travelers to his beloved otherworldly stretch of coastline. Were it not for him, many of those visitors would not have known that the Outer Banks even existed. He was attuned to the uncannily everyday life of the place, its street parades and fashion shows and oyster shoots and pirate festivals, as he was to its wildlife, the pelicans and fiddler crabs and wind-beaten tree skeletons, the ancient shipwrecks that washed up on its shifting shores. Brown loved to mingle the two worlds, posing majorettes and marching bands on the Jockey Ridge's dunes, and costumed members of the Lost Colony cast dancing on the beach. And I'll interrupt this to say there is a picture over here on the side. It's in black and white. A lot of young women in one-piece bathing suits with, I guess, the drum majorettes, because they all have the batons outstretched from their right arms as they face us. It says, Brown's Moon and Wright Memorial in 1969 was inspired by the Apollo 11 landing. He also photographed people in unusual settings, a couple atop the Helen Benedict shipwreck in 1950, also shown here, and majorettes on Jockey's Ridge in 1954. One of Brown's best-known pictures, the Lunar Crescent, that he framed rising over the Wright Brothers National Memorial just as he heard the news of the moon landing on July 20th, 1969, captures place and time in a way that the photographer, writer, and one-man press bureau did himself, almost single-handedly introducing the rest of the world to the Outer Banks in the mid-20th century. Fellow North Carolina photographer Hugh Morton once called him the Barker of the Banks. A New York Times photographer referred to Brown warmly in a tribute as the con man of the Outer Banks for his legendary ability to lure a group of photojournalists out to the barrier islands on the vaguest, thinnest of promises to wait for a porpoise to swim by, say, or to witness a hurricane that never materialized. Brown's response to such ribbing was likely some form of the perpetual good-natured grandpa grin that he sported in the many pictures of him. Photos show him in a variations of a uniform that he wore on his rounds, typically a Hawaiian shirt, a straw boater hat, and several cameras slung around his neck. In others, he's perched over his typewriter, the backdrop a wall of pictures of attractive models in a cluttered office that regularly communicated with hundreds of newsrooms around the country. A neat desk is the sign of a sick mind, read a piece of paper attached to the Venetian blinds next to Brown's workspace, and surrounded by evidence of that constant correspondence with newspapers and magazines everywhere. In Icock Brown's Outer Banks, a photo book published on the occasion of Brown's semi-retirement in 1976, Morton wrote of the photographer's colleagues, each editor has been made to feel by Icock that Icock was serving as his extra staff member. Charles Brantley Icock Brown was born in 1904 in rural western North Carolina, Happy Valley in Caldwell County, not all that far from where I grew up. It also wasn't far from the birthplace of the Outer Banks' other most famous resident, Andy Griffith. And what Griffith would do for Mount Airy, Brown did for the then largely unknown Barrier Islands. Dare County, where he was hired as the director of the newly formed Tourist Bureau in the 1950s, became Brown's Mayberry on the Coast, a quaint idyll that he presented in photos, captions, and stories sent all over the country, detailing its pirate history and its fishing lore, its vast dunes and wild ponies, and the funny and strange and lovely rituals of small-town life. It is perhaps because of Brown, that this image remains many people's perception of the Outer Banks, down to the Dare Coast Pirates Jamboree, an annual festival that he loved. In his archives, Jamboree programs dating back to early handmade-looking pamphlets touting events like the world's largest outdoor fish fry, a caravan of decorated beach buggies, and a jumping frog contest. In his archives, a personal invitation from Calaveras County, California, home of the original jumping frog contest and subject of a famous early short story by Mark Twain. Brown's own biography is worthy of one of Twain's hucksters. An early apprenticeship with a printer in Hillsboro put him on the path to becoming a newspaper man, a line of work that he continued in Elizabeth City and Durham and polished in classes at Columbia University. He remained, by his own admission, an incorrigibly bad speller. By his 20s, he landed in Ocracoke on vacation, or to bootleg booze, as he sometimes later admitted, or both, and was planning to go next to Cuba to take a job as a press agent for a carnival. Two things stopped him from making it there. He was offered room and board at the Pamlico Inn in exchange for promoting stories to lure visitors to Ocracoke, and he met his future wife, Esther Styron, whom he married in 1929. Anyone else might have bottomed out in tourism and amid the Great Depression and World War II, but again, Twain wouldn't have written it that way, and a person possessed of Brown's doggedness wouldn't have stood for it. He struggled, but he rebounded gamely. As a civilian intelligence agent during the war, his grimmer duties included identifying bodies, human and animal, that washed up on the coast. His nascent press agent efforts helped make him famous throughout the state, a then-fledgling seafood place that 85 years later remains a beloved icon, the Sanitary Fish Market and Restaurant in Morehead City. And when attendance dwindled about a decade into the life of the Lost Colony in 1948, Brown stepped in as publicity director and helped revive the symphonic outdoor drama. He was hired full-time to run the Dare County Tourist Bureau in 1952. This was another fortuitous merger of person, place, and time. Brown's intuition for improvised promotion and his innate love for the Outer Banks converged with the start of the golden age of the American road trip. His column covering the waterfront was syndicated across North Carolina, and he also placed hundreds of photographs in newspapers nationwide. When he first moved to Ocracoke, Brown possessed perhaps the only typewriter on the island, but he was canny enough to understand that his words would be enhanced by pictures. Soon, photography was an equal, if not predominant, aspect of his work. His press clippings, now pasted haphazardly in stationery store photo albums and scrapbooks in his physical archives, show rows and rows of the same image in newspapers from Iowa to Los Angeles. Alongside each other, the everyday models that he posed with record-sized fish have a Warholian effect, a pretty young woman and the boy. Each posing for scale were Brown's Marilyn and Elvis. Over the years, more than 100,000 Outer Banks photographs and stories were published across America thanks to Brown's persistence. He sold his own Outer Banks articles to publications like the Saturday Evening Post, and he fact-checked a Lonely Hatteras feature by National Geographic journalist whose story was very likely prompted by Brown's work. He repeatedly fed the Wood, Field, and Stream column in New York Times, and he even merited a mention in at least one headline, "Icock Brown's Got the Outer Banks Blues." A June 1958 article drew on telegrams that he'd sent to the writer, documenting the return of a bluefish in numbers unseen in two decades. He's a writer with fresh material and the divine flush of inspiration. John W. Randolph wrote in his column, Brown had become as much of a character as his place. Though he wasn't a fisherman, Brown's photographed the members of the Cape Hatteras Anglers Club so often that they awarded him an honorary embroidered patch. He caught Martin while honeymooning, a Brown headline recounted of a groom fishing aboard the Stormy Duchess. No marching band went unphotographed when Brown was around, and no subject was too small for a story, whether the First Flight Society or the convening of the Southeastern Potato Committee. Experts discuss spud problems during Nag's Head meet, headlines another clipping. Before my visit to the Outer Banks History Center, what struck me when I looked through his prodigious online archive was how naturally and seamlessly his personal photographs of his family blended with his public pictures of the Outer Banks. I think that Icock Brown promoted this place as a family-oriented area, not some hot, wild, exciting place, archivist Tama Kreef says. Come on, it was quiet, it's peaceful. There are the people who live here. She hands me boxes filled with scrapbooks of his glued-on photographs and clippings, handmade brochures, marked-up typewriter letters, pitches and drafts. And I think that because of that, he slowed the overdevelopment. The people who came here weren't looking for parties. They were looking for a quiet place to fish. Framed in Brown's pictures, too, is an awareness of the coastal natural world that most beach developers tend to strip away. In an age before macro lenses were widely used, he'd get down on his hands and knees to take a picture of a flower, Creef says. His prose ran from fervent, a thicket of live oaks near Salter Path, he wrote, was a verdant magic carpet floating through a sea of blue and green, to droll. Helpless newborn egret glares unhappily at photographer from nest at PI Refuge, read one of his captions. It accompanied an image of a downy, scoldy bird that in 1948 ran in papers in Oil City, Pennsylvania, and Burlington, Vermont. In the colder months, the waves rise higher on the Outer Banks, and the latest generation of those scowly birds has the run of the beach. The morning after I visited Brown's archives, I drive through Hatteras, passing motels shuttered for the season and embodying the frozen-in-time feeling of his photographs from more than half a century before. On Ocracoke, just down the road from the ferry, I pull off on the Sound side to visit the Banker ponies, possibly descendants of the horses that 17th-century ships left behind when they set sail back to Europe. Unlike their northern county parts, the wild horses of Corolla, and their southern ones, the Shackleford ponies, both of whom roam freely, protected by steep vines and potential jail time for any human that violates their physical boundaries, the Ocracoke Banker ponies have resided in a maritime pasture since the late 1950s. A tall fence surrounds their range. Egrets and herons wade through the nearby marsh, but the squat, sturdy ponies, dun and brown and spotted ones, all meditatively feeding near their stables, pay them no mind. Though you can clamber atop to overlook for another view, it's impossible to get physically close to the Banker ponies, except, of course, via a photograph. I shouldn't be surprised to encounter reproductions of Brown's photographs of the Banker ponies here. Displayed on a placard just outside the corral that safeguards the horses from humans, also while allowing us to look closer, the photos serve to both shield and invitation. It strikes me that this is the real legacy of Brown's work. In his own time, his photographs were a beacon drawing people from all over to a strange remote wilderness and the small communities that had grown up on its edges. The images were instrumental in molding both the identity and the spirit of a place. They are still beacons reminding us that we are tourists in a wilderness, calling on us not just to come here, but also to protect it and let it be. This is the lesson of his pictures, which are so intrinsically of the world they depict that they are now a living part of its landscape. And now, how Bull City got its bull. The true story, mixed with local lore, of how Durham became forever linked with its bovine mascot. When you're in the main square of downtown Durham, you'll see a 10-foot bronze bull statue in the southeast corner of the plaza. Children chase each other in circles around his hooves. Tourists climb on his back for a photo op. Bulls are everywhere in Durham. From the main square, you can walk a few blocks in the baseball stadium to see the Durham Bulls play. On your way, you might grab a burger and fried pickles at Bull City Burger and Brewery. 26% off if you show your restaurant-approved bull tattoo. Strolling through downtown, you'll pass dozens of iterations of the bull, featured in business names and logos, from laundromats to bars to gyms to metal fabricators to apartment complexes. You might guess that the bull of Bull City has something to do with a town history involving livestock, but actually the bull comes from tobacco ads in the 19th century. And before that, it all goes back to a jar of mustard. A Yankee packs his pipe with lemon-colored tobacco. It's lighter than the stuff he's used to. It smells sweeter, too, like dry autumn leaves seasoned with nutmeg or cinnamon. He lights the pipe, and the sweet scent mingles with campfire smoke, putting the soldier at ease. It's been a long 4 years, and he aches for home. By Easter weekend, 1865, the Civil War is already over for most of the country. Sherman has marched. Lee has surrendered his troops. Lincoln's been shot. but the Yankee is waiting for his commander to negotiate the terms of surrender with the Confederate General Joseph E. Johnson, who still has nearly 90,000 troops under his command. General Johnson encamped in Greensboro, and Union General William Tecumseh Sherman encamped in Raleigh have agreed to meet in the middle at Durham Station to negotiate what will be the largest surrender of troops of the entire war. While the brass are hashing out the terms at a local farmer's kitchen table, a ceasefire is declared, and soldiers in gray and blue stop, swap stories, sip whiskey, and smoke the local tobacco. The lemon-colored leaf is the result of a curing technique developed by Piedmont farmers and enslaved workers that uses sudden intense heat instead of the common air-drying method. It's called bright leaf, and the soldiers fall in love with it. When the troops disperse for home, heading north and south, they raid tobacco warehouses and stuff their pockets and rucksacks with the yellow leaves. Until now, no one has heard of Durham. It's scarcely more than a railroad station with 100 or so people scattered in farmhouses and shanties. Now, with the collapse of the Confederacy and a crushed economy, the hamlet's future looks grim. But hosting the surrender turns out to be a lucky strike for Durham, although John Green, a local tobacco businessman, doesn't know it yet. All he knows is that his factory has been ransacked and his entire storehouse of tobacco is gone. I'm done for, he thinks. But then former soldiers, now back home in Virginia, Washington, D.C., and New York, start sending inquiries to the station master in Durham. Where can we get more of that sweet yellow tobacco? Green can't keep up with the orders pouring in from around the country. He needs a business partner. He also needs a new trademark. Competitors are using his product name, Spanish-flavored and Durham Tobacco, and he wants to rebrand. According to local lore, Green meets a friend, John Whitted, for lunch in Hillsboro. On the menu are fried oysters dredged from the coast in the wee hours and shipped west on the morning train. The men dip the sweet, cool oysters into spicy mustard and talk shop. Whitted points to the nearby jar of Coleman's mustard, whose yellow and red label features a bull. That would make a good local for your tobacco business, he tells Green. The bull in the mustard jar is not just any bull. It's a Durham Shorthorn, the famed breed from Durham, England, and everyone knows that it's one of the best, most coveted, and most expensive types of cattle. Within days, Green has a Shorthorn bull painted on a sheet of iron and mounted on the front of his tobacco factory. Green gets to enjoy the success of his brand for only a few years before he dies of tuberculosis. He doesn't get to see Bull Durham tobacco become known around the world as the best, most coveted type of pipe tobacco. He doesn't get to see his business partner, W.T. Blackwell, spend unprecedented sums in advertising, $150,000 annually on newspaper ads alone, more than $3 million in 2023 dollars. He doesn't get to see the rise of advertising murals in which sign painters known as wall dogs plastered the Durham Bull on brick buildings as far away as Canada and Europe. He doesn't get to see the years of litigation against other tobacco companies that attempt to use the name Durham and the Bull logo. And he doesn't see the eventual acquisition of his brand by the American Tobacco Company led by James Buck Duke, which grows to control 91% of the tobacco industry worldwide before Congress starts busting up monopolies. Walk around downtown Durham today and you won't smell the sweet, earthy aroma of tobacco being cured, cut, bagged, sold, and smoked. Every third or fourth person you meet works in healthcare or education, not tobacco. But you'll see many of the factory buildings that prepared the bright leaf that made Durham famous. Now those brick buildings contain condos, restaurants, and startup companies. You'll also find that Durham is still home to people like John Green, entrepreneurs with the ambition to turn their small ideas into big business, and you'll still find bulls everywhere. And I know that we don't have time for the next article, so I'm going to go back to the beginning of the magazine on page 17, where we're going to find North Carolina icons. The North Carolina Zoo. There is a picture here of a polar bear. It says, while spring marks the end of mating season for the zoo's only male polar bear, Peyton, it marks the beginning of the Zoofari African wildlife adventures in the Watani grasslands. Starting in April, tour goers can spot exotic species like the fringe-eared onyx. It's a picture here of the vehicle, which is a like a truck with an elongated back and sides and a canvas roof and open sides that people can look out. It's kind of like a bus with no windows. Peyton, a 1,000-pound polar bear, rests on a bed in his chilled cave in the Rocky Coast exhibit at the North Carolina Zoo, just feet from the glass that separates him from visitors. He's right there, says a boy on a field trip, pointing and staring at Peyton's dinner plate-sized paws. Nearly every day since the zoo opened in 1974, school children have been amazed by decades-old reptiles, chimpanzees swinging from vines, and the more than 1,700 other animals that reside there. The zoo's diverse habitats sit on a 2,600 wooded acres plot near Ashboro and serve as centers of discovery, rehabilitation, and conservation for the creatures that have found a sanctuary and plenty of fans in Randolph County. Strategically placed in the geographical center of North Carolina, the zoo offers free admission for students on school trips, meaning that generations of North Carolinians have made unforgettable memories at one of our state's wildest destinations. The North Carolina Zoo is at Zoo Parkway in Ashboro, and they have a website, of course, nczoo.org. It's all in the name. In 2018, the rare birth of a southern white rhinoceros at the North Carolina Zoo led staff members wondering how to name the new calf. The zoo released a public poll with a selection of names inspired by female leaders, from which three finalists were chosen. The newborn's father, Stormy, got the final say when he selected a treat-laden pole inscribed with the name of a 19th-century southern African queen, Nandi, an ode to the species' origins. Crowdsourcing names has helped the zoo strengthen the connection between its animals and the community. In 2021, zoo fans named a new litter of red wolves, an endangered species now only found in the wild of the Albemarle, Pensacola. Choosing from a list of southern waterways, visitors can now see the litter, including Eno, Fisher, and Catawba, in the North American section of the zoo. And here's a picture. It says southern white rhinoceros Linda and her daughter Nandi graze on the Watani grasslands. Meanwhile, the zoo's red wolf breeding program has grown its pack to around 35 members. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. Hope you enjoyed it enough that you'll come back next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving our community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Questions, comments, call the studios 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.